on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, spending the hour today with 89-year-old Don Straub of Windsor, Colorado. He served as a radio man and gunner on PB-4Y-2 Privateers, the Navy version of B-24s during World War II, flying low-altitude missions with VPB-109, that stands for Patrol Bombing Squadron. He spent time based in the Philippines, Iwo Jima, and Okinawa. And let's pick up where we left off.
I think the worst place in the world that we were was Iwo Jima. It was a horrible place. It was tough to fly off of it. There was a sulfur coming out of the runways, and it was just a horrible place to be.
Well, and folks obviously have heard about Iwo Jima, and they know what the Marines did, and maybe they know that the whole reason the Marines were there was just so planes could be able to hop over. When did you get there, and were there still some reminders of what had happened there on the ground?
Oh, yeah. We got there in June. We went from Tinian to Iwo, flying Dumbo service, looking for 51 pilots, 29 crews, so we could get in touch with submarines so they could pick them up.
So you guys were flying low altitude, just scanning everything to try to spot downed pilots so that the people in the water could rescue them.
That's exactly right. And we'd be back in touch with them to tell them where they were. That was primarily the job.
And how often did you guys actually spot someone? Was it something where you're looking hours a day and maybe once every few days you see someone? Or how frequent did that actually occur?
It didn't occur to us. I mean, our crew, we never spotted anybody. But we did. One afternoon, we were in touch with a submarine, our submarine. In order to make contact, you had to have identification, friend or foe, on your gear. It was forgot to be, it was not turned on. The sub made the surface, and a minute he broke service, he was gone again, because we didn't do the right thing, and it was our fault. But the pilot forgot to put the IFF on, identification, which that sub would have got. But that was a scary moment. I thought, oh boy, these guys are coming up here and looking for us, and they think we're somebody else. They're liable to surf and shoot at us, for crying out loud.
They probably thought the same thing of you.
Absolutely. That's why he stuck a nose down and went back down again. Oh, yeah.
You talked about the plane getting shot up a little bit. Is there one story or a few stories that really illustrate that maybe once you came back from that mission, you had to catch your breath a little bit and say, wow, that was close?
It happened out of Okinawa a lot. We were in Okinawa when they were still fighting down in Naha. We were up on a Yantan airstrip, and we would fly there, and we'd go along the coast almost into Japan. And we bumped into some fighters that particular flight. And when we come back, we looked at, and we had bullet holes in the bottom of the plane. How they got there, I don't. But our propellers had dinks and holes in them, so we lost the propeller one afternoon on that flight. So it was a little scary. But most of the time, you got back without any real damage. We did lose our airplane the night that they came into Okinawa on a suicide mission. They crash-land their airplanes up on the strip, and our planes were parked up there, and we had guards. Of course, the guy from the crew would stay over there all night. Some of the planes that crash-land, the Japanese got out and were running up and down the runway or the tarmacs, throwing grenades into planes, and that's where we lost our first airplane. It was blown up that night. But there was one airplane that came right over the top of our tent area, crash land right behind us. Two of those Japanese got out of that plane, how I'll never know. And one was dragging the other one when the Marines showed up and said those two are still alive. And I saw the gun. They had a little gun, and I picked it. It was hot. I picked it up, and the Marine said, put that down. He's still alive. I dropped the gun. It was going to be a souvenir. And I ran, and it was. But that was the most frightening night I ever remember. It's when they crash-landed and destroyed a lot of the airplanes, which I have a picture of in my book. I'll show the tail section was all that was left. Then we got another airplane out there. They flew one out.
Were you actually asleep when this started? Did this wake you up?
It was at nighttime, yes. And they came over. When we come back off of a mission, we were able to go out. They would take us out to a seaplane tender for shower, ice water, and some nice food. And that was kind of a treat. You knew you were going to be if you got back okay. We didn't make a bomb that day, but that night is when they came over. And I mean, there was, I don't know how many airplanes, But I've got some pictures of them laying around, and it was a scary night. We didn't know whether there was more alive or whatever it was. They knew the island better than we did.
Is that one of those, when you think back on it now, where you think someone was looking out for me, or I'm pretty fortunate to be around, that maybe we came close to Colorado State not making the 1950 College World Series?
I never thought about Colorado in the College World Series in those days. All I know is I want to get home, which I did. I'll never forget that night as long as I live, ever. And that was the most terrifying night. Because you didn't know the island, you didn't know about the island, you don't know if there were Japanese still out there, because the battle is still going on in Naha, and the Marines were battling. They had to help out the Army, because Marines went north and cleaned out things, and then the Army went south. They got stuck, and that's when Marines had to come back down and clear out the bottom part of Naha and Okinawa. But then we were told to move when it was all over. We had to move to another airstrip.
The whole time you were over there, and I imagine as transient as you guys were with all the moving here and there, that it might have been hard for people back home to get a package to you. How often did you hear from your family?
We did letters. That's all. Never got a package. Never was sent any package. Very few of us ever got any packages. We did get mail, and we couldn't write very much because they would censor ours because we were moving around so much. But I did bump into a Marine in our tent area who was from my high school, and they were able to write a letter to their folks telling them where they were. But we couldn't. So when my mother would get my letters, it was all chopped up. And she never knew where we were until I saw this friend of mine. I said, well, you write your mother. Tell your mother to call my mother and let her know where we are. And that's how she found out we were at Okinawa. Letters were letters. It was nice to have them, but I never made a big deal over the letters. It was just nice to hear that somebody was home on leave or liberty or whatever it was. Well, maybe we'll get back home. I'll be home soon. I was homesick. You bet I was homesick. I wanted to get home.
Did you ever have enough time to get to know a little bit about some of these islands that you were on and see what the natives, how they lived?
Oh, yeah. We were down in the Philippines, and I don't know what they were called or what tribe or whatever it was, but they come in one evening, loincloths on, hair up in the air, and they were hunters. They had big swords, knives, and they were out looking for the enemy. They were helping our situation.
When you think back on all those missions and everything that you went through, is there one moment that you think that was the closest I came to not coming home?
Well, I think it was the run we made up in Korea to knock out the bridge. That was a little scary. We were jumped by the enemy aircraft after we had done a lot of the damage. That one was probably the worst of all. But they all had significance to them, hoping that you don't get blown out or you get back okay. Every mission. One time I was grounded. I was drinking warm beer at Iwo, and I broke out, and I didn't know what the devil hives were. I had no idea what they were. I went to the doctor, and he says, well, he said, you been drinking any? I said, yeah. He said, you been drinking warm beer? I said, yeah. He said, that's it. So the crew flew that day, and I didn't make that, but I was not able to go because I didn't know. I thought I had some crazy jungle disease. I didn't know what the hives were. Gosh. But Iwo, to me, was a horrible place. You took a shower in salt water. Although we did have Quonset huts. The officers had tents, the pilots. We got rain off of the roofs in barrels so we could wash ourselves, but you had salt water soap. It was a horrible place. Of course, they had the whole island was tunneled, and we walked into some of those things, and they had shelves cut out to where they slept.
I've heard some stories about some of those caves and tunnels being booby-trapped, too. Did you ever hear about any of that?
Oh, that's very true. I think the things were pretty well cleaned up when we got there. The southern part was Mount Suribachi. They could not believe that the American Seabees cut a road to the top of that thing. And we were, I said, holy smoke. Coming into it, we flew over those landing beaches that they hit. Boy, and they shelled it. We shelled it and bombed it and bombed it. And it didn't do very much because of the lava. It would just hit and smother the bomb. Nothing. They were ready for us when we got there. We were not in actual ground contact, but we knew what was going on. But they cleaned it out pretty well. After the Marines cleaned out the Suribachi area, then they moved the other way and did a good job. that was a tough situation for those guys.
Specifically about your missions, you know, people heard you say that you're flying 100 to 200 feet off the ground, and we've heard, you know, fighter bomber pilots flying P-47s or P-51s that they would do skip bombing, and we've heard about how they did that. But when you're flying a basically a B-24 that low and dropping a bomb, how do you avoid being impacted yourself?
When you make your run, you open your bomb bay doors, that thing takes a few minutes to get it down there. You're beyond the ship then. You're beyond it. There's no problem. But we were strictly low-altitude bombers. Reason was it that we could do a lot of damage. We ended up with what is today a missile. We had what they called the bat bomb. It was on attached to our wing. And I would operate that when the pilot would say release, the throw forth. It was like the radar and that bat bomb. It was the first thing ever came out. And our squadron was awarded that. I don't know how many worked, but I know that some of us got rid of them once in a while. But that, to me, was the first kind of missile thing. It was an automatic bomb.
So you would press a button, and it would release and go?
Release it and just take off, and you had it geared to the target. That's just the first thing I ever saw then. It was a dumb-looking thing.
What was it propelled by?
It was just let it go, just like a bomb.
It would just coast in like a glider would or something?
Yeah, just like that. Of course, the Japs had one of those things, too, like the rockets that they had in Europe. But I saw one of those on the island of Okinawa.
You mentioned earlier the timing with the bombing of Hiroshima and how that crew had been lost the day before. But when you guys found out that Imperial Japan had surrendered, how significant was that news to you, and how did you all react?
When the first thing hit, it was raining, it was soggy, and the pilots came down to tell us more about it, to our tent and our crew. That was the evening that we celebrated. But now we were concerned, and then they dropped the second one. And now we're thinking, boy, maybe it's all over. Well, it was. It was all over then. And we were thinking about, let's get home, let's go out. And that's when we started to put things back together and worked our way back. We come back to Guam. We had to spend 2 weeks in Guam in order for the commander in the Pacific, Nimitz at that time, told us in Guam, you can fly your airplanes all the way back to the States. So we went from Guam to Johnson Island to Honolulu. We spent a couple, three, 4 days in Honolulu, and we flew off to Barbara's Point. Started out, and we had engine trouble, had to come back, and we're thinking, oh God, are we going to make it? Come back, had it fixed. And we come back the next day, took off, went all the way, then we flew into Naval Air Station Alameda, and we were home. I got on my knees and kissed that ground. Boy, and we had to contact them and tell them who we were, where we're from. Alameda had no idea. Here we come in with these airplanes, and that big broad painted on the side of the plane. We were kind of an unusual group coming in there.
What was it like to see your family again after everything you'd been through?
That's a story in itself. We were waiting at Naval Air Station to get leave to go home. A lot of the guys were awarded the DFC, the Distinguished Flying Cross. And I was on the plane that we made this bridge run and knocked out the bridges and everything else, and I manned the turret.
That was in Korea?
That was in the Korea deal. Anyway, our ACI officer, the intelligence guy, was quite a guy, a teacher. He taught then at Columbia University later on. He issued the different awards. Well, I went up to him. I said, Commander Steele, I says, I was on that flight. I was in that airplane. Why didn't I get the DFC? He says, let me tell you something. He says, there's going to be a lot of guys getting discharged, and there's going to be a jam out there. And you could get a DFC. You got a DFC. You got discharged almost immediately.
Because of the points you got from it.
Exactly. Well, I didn't get the DFC, but the third-class radioman got one. And so Steele, that's what Ted Steele, Commander Steele, said to me. He said, Don, I'm giving you a break. You don't want to go out there right now because everybody's coming home. And he knew that I wanted to go to school somewhere. So that was my delay. And I came back, and my good friend, his name was Ike Ritchie. He was from Hazard, Kentucky. We went to Los Angeles from Alameda. We thumbed at Los Angeles. And there were guys driving cars back east. You could pay $50, get a ride to Chicago. So we did. Well, Ike and I and another guy, Bill Smith, we got as far as Springfield, Missouri. I thought, damn, this is a nice town. We were the only sailors in town. So we had a ball. We had a good time. People took us into their homes. And the next day, Bill went on to Illinois. Ike and I continued on thumbing from Springfield to Louisville, Kentucky. We got to Louisville, we're broke. We don't have a dime. So Ike gets a hold of his mother and dad. They send us money for a Greyhound bus trip to Hazard, Kentucky. Have you ever been to Hazard, Kentucky? I haven't, never been. But Hazard is a little old mining town. And that's where I spent some more of my liberty with Ike and his girlfriend and sister. And we did a little of that Blucum drinking, that white lightning stuff that they make down there, which is very good. But boy, it burns. So when I got home on the train from Louisville to Pittsburgh, I probably had maybe 10, 12 days of my leave left. And so that was it. And I had to get back on the train, come all the way back out to Alameda, and spend another 3 or 4 months. I was discharged in March or April of 46 in St. Louis, Missouri. I flew Naval Air Transport Service as a crewman out of Olathe, Kansas, and went from coast to coast, and then I had enough points to get out. My service record is all right there.
When you think back of those days, and you've shared a good chunk of it, I'm sure there's much more inside your brain from those days, but what, when you think back on it, what are you most proud of?
I'm proud of the guys who won the war. We won the war. And I'll still say the reason that we were so controlled and so dedicated is growing up in my time, what your mom and dad said to you, you did it. Or somebody else said, this is the way it's going to be. That's the way it was. And I think the fellows that were in the service brought that with them. And when the commander, whoever it was, said, this is what we're going to do, this is what you're not going to do, we did it. And that's what I think got us to where we were at the end of the war. Because I think we were conditioned to that kind of control. That's exactly the way I look at it, and I may be wrong, but I still think when my mom and dad said, you don't do that, I didn't do it.
Well, and that's going to lead us right into the story of how you ended up here on the Front Range in northern Colorado, wearing those beautiful pumpkin and alfalfa uniforms of Colorado A&M, since then, of course, having morphed into the green and gold of Colorado State University. That story involves listening to your father, I know, and little did you know, you'd make a little College World Series history in Omaha. We're going to get to that part of the story from 89-year-old Don Straub when Hometown Heroes comes down the home stretch after this.